Hey, it's Peter here with my FSHD.
Well, ain't we a pair, Raggedy Man?
All right. Well, I'm here with the CRISPR goddess. Is going to help me answer some questions. The old Dr. Carissa Maida, and I shouldn't say old. The young Dr. Carissa Maida.
You said old.
Well, so old. Yeah. I've been learning.
It's old, like with the apostrophe.
Well, you know, it's nowadays you got to be so careful what you say, right? I mean, seriously, I was thinking about this the other day because I was at UPS returning and yet another one of my mom's Amazon packages because evidently she just orders stuff and returns it. It's obvious, something you can do now when you're 88. Yeah. I'm like, all right, man. I just say man all the time. Hey, thanks, man. Thanks, man. You know, and
you get in trouble?
Well, I'm worried about that. One, legitimately, because sometimes you just got no idea, but it's not actually using it as a gender term. It's like, all right, man.
Yeah, it's a generic term, but you just shouldn't get up in the morning.
I'm like, thanks, man. All right, man. So, you know, hey, I just say they're just little things you just say nowadays that now you say something and it just gets you fired.
Yep.
I got legitimate things I should be fired for. Not... No, but you know, you're
going
to
ask.
It's going to be like Al Capone going down for tax
evasion.
That's
exactly right. You're going to go down for.
Anyway, but I digress. All right, man. You know, so I was. See? There you go, man. All right, man. So I got to tell you, I said that the first time it really caught me is I was getting a flu injection. I'm like, all right, thanks, man. And do you ever remember Pat from Saturday Night Live?
The Pat skits?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Pat gave me the injection, and I was just suddenly horrified because, anyway, I don't want to upset anybody. I'm just it may not seem that way. People may probably think I'm always like trying to just like stir the pot.
I mean, no, you can't help it.
But stirring the pot is one thing. Sometimes you need to say things and be a little controversial to get things done, to get people moving.
People inflamed for the right reasons.
Or to get people talking about things. Hey, did you hear what Peter said? You know, for the, the 12 listeners we have say, oh my God, can you believe? And they call up Tamara Gottlieb and say, oh my God, did you hear what Peter said? And Michael's got to get on and listen to the podcast again. I know. Sometimes you got to say stuff, but this is the subconscious stuff that you say. This is why I'm so glad I don't teach anymore. One of the many reasons I'm so glad I don't have a class.
Yeah.
Yeah,
no one can get to us in this bomb shelter that we speak in.
Well, I mean, I just know in class and lecture hall. Oh my God, it's there'd be YouTube videos of it's also the why the people, kids love the class that I taught. There's no textbook.
You got an award up there that says you're the best teacher of something something.
Well, yeah, voted. Yeah, I was actually still winning the students' choice best course 2 years after I left Illinois. Seriously, they're saying bring it back. Well, he's gone, we threw him out.
They put up a little dummy figure of you propped up.
Well, I mean,
yelling at everybody.
Well, it's because I talked to the top of the class and challenged students, right? I mean, that class actually, I'd have 45 kids on day one and I'd have 16 on day two.
That's right.
Or day three.
The diehards appreciated the.
And that's what the kids always said. They always were like, man, why aren't there more classes like this?
Yeah.
No textbook, primary literature. We designed experiments. We interpreted data.
We
had some cultural stuff. Man, we did music. We did the works.
The easiest way to teach a college class is to just have, multiple choice tests, Scantrons, get your TAs to grade them, everything memorized. But to actually teach people how to think critically, which is really important in science. You know, these are a lot of science majors. They want to go into science. They want to do research. And I had one class out of all the classes I took in my biochem major where I was forced to think critically. And yeah, that's exactly what happens. Half the kids drop out after the first day or two.
I mean, I knew that it's interesting, the worst thing you can do as a professor nowadays is catch a kid cheating.
Oh yeah,
you will get sued. Let me tell you, you are at fault if your kid. You catch a kid cheating, especially depending on who that kid is.
It's a different day.
That's the level of trouble you're in, and if you catch a kid cheating, and so I just always had open book, open notes, whatever.
Yeah,
and I even tell them sometimes what the test questions are.
Well, that's the beauty. If you have a class focused on kids learning how to think critically, there's no such thing as cheating.
Well, that was the point, right?
No book is going to help you. No notes are going to help you. You have to think.
But that was the point. I sort of had this design an experiment. I would have design an experiment to address this here's the problem, design a set of experiments to address this. You know, explain your thinking.
Yeah, go through your notes madly and figure it out.
Whatever, man. And the thing is, if you could figure it out, I mean, it's fine. I also gave him certain things that was, I always told, it was actually kind of, I can really digress in here, but, my first question on the first exam, I told him ahead of time, it would be compare and contrast DNA methylation and histone methylation. And they always thought, oh, I can't believe you're telling me. And they all got it right. But you know what? It meant that they all knew what the, it's like, this is what I want you to know. Fundamental stuff. Define epigenetics and how it's different than genetics. That was question number two, you know, and it's like, what's wrong with them knowing that? So I only had one kid ever miss that. I guess I still know his name. I still remember his name. He's actually a professor at a small school in Missouri. I think about
it. We shall remain anonymous.
But his rationale was, oh, I thought you were joking. He's like,
is very successful, is what you're saying.
He wasn't a horrible student, but he was one of those students. He just figured I was trying to trick him.
Trying to trick him.
This is what you need to know for the exam. Well, I will not know that, because that clearly you would never dare ask that. That's the mentality of some students. Anyway, he got his PhD. Anyone can get a PhD. Anyway, so I guess the point is, I'm hoping, you just got to be very careful what you say and everything. So hopefully, I hope we're not too horribly offensive.
What are we planning to say today?
Well, you never know. This is unscripted. This is how we go. Anyway.
That's scary.
All right. So, Tina Turner died. We'll be using what I consider a great 80s Tina song.
Oh, yeah.
Which will be a song for the day.
Love 80s music.
It just got me, I just couldn't believe, when the entertainers you grew up with start dying, man, ow.
You're next.
Don't they know it? I'm indestructible.
All right. Sorry. The rest of us are next.
All right. Well, what we did say is we're going to answer questions, okay, from people. And
we eventually get around to that, don't we?
We have question number one, how do I make myself indestructible?
Well, how about my stand inhibition?
Yes.
As a possibility. Let's talk about that.
All right. So we did get our first question was about, and I appreciate everybody who sent in questions, because, we give us some material. We want to be responsive to the community, right? So I get questions emailed all the time, but this, I got a good number of questions. So the question was they wanted my opinion about the Roche clinical trial that's coming up, myostatin inhibition. And as is pointed out, it says Acceleron tested an abandoned ACE-83, which is a myostatin inhibitor for the treatment of FSHD, because it was not effective. What's the difference between that drug and the Roche drug that's going to trial, right? And the second part of it was, why have muscle mass as an endpoint as opposed to muscle function? Right, ACE-83 significantly increased muscle mass, but failed to improve muscle function. Right, those are excellent questions.
They are.
So actually, I gotta tell you, it is comforting to know that when the level of questions we get actually suggests we got a pretty smart audience.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
I mean, and so it's actually really good. I'm not getting the bonehead questions. Not that there's anything wrong with that.
Nobody asks what DNA is anymore. It's really good.
That's true. The first time I gave a presentation, what is this thing you call protein?
We got to start with the basics sometimes, but no, that's
right.
Great.
So these are great. It actually is a great point, because myostatin inhibition is been floated around for 20 years in the muscular dystrophies. And so why don't you tell us a little bit about it, because people would rather hear you talk than me.
So myostatin is a negative regulator of muscle growth, basically. And so that
naturally
is,
occurring.
Yeah,
right?
Naturally occurring. The idea is that if you, inhibit an inhibitor, you will get, larger muscles. And the hope was that these larger muscles would be stronger, which really has not.
So there's a reason your muscles are how they are.
Exactly.
Pretty much your whole body is how they are.
Yeah.
Right? You're not just a
random
mixture of goo,
right?
I mean, you have positive regulators and negative.
And bigger
regulators
doesn't always equal better. I mean, think of, cardiac hypertrophy. That's not a good thing. Muscle hypertrophy, in cases like muscle atrophy or age-related, sarcopenia, where muscles naturally get smaller, maybe something that increases the size of muscles would be beneficial. But in the case of muscle diseases, where you're not actually curing the primary problem, myostatin inhibition has not turned out to be very useful.
But you understand why it's attractive, though.
Oh, yeah.
Right? So the idea is, that, you know, we always go back to the same. You got a hole in the boat and you're bailing the boat out faster, or you're pumping up the football. You know, we got a leak in the system and you're pumping it up and trying to beat the system. Maybe you got a leak in your air conditioning and your whatever, you know. And so you're not fixing the leak, but you're just trying to pump it up far enough and then kind of buying some time,
right,
you know.
Right.
And, you know, you see these animals. You can make myostatin mutations.
Oh, yeah. Remember the bull? Everyone remembers the picture of the bull.
Yeah, this is an enormous bull, man. Mutation. Looks like Andre the
cut.
Giant, man.
He is Arnold Schwarzenegger of bulls.
Yeah, I mean, it's just, you think, wow, you know. And, you know, so if he had a muscle disease.
Women were swooning.
Well, speak for yourself.
You might have to edit that out.
I don't know what kind of parties you've been going to. Anyway. So see what I mean? You gotta be careful.
Yeah, yeah. I could sue him after this is over.
You can have all I'm worth. Okay. Get in line.
Yeah.
Get in line, sister. So anyway. But it's, so, you know, in a certain level it works, right? And so, you know, that's where Acceleron, who has recently been bought out by Merck, I think a couple of years ago, Merck bought Acceleron. But Acceleron at the time, and 5 years ago maybe, had a drug called ACE-83. And that is a myostatin inhibitor that was anchored locally. So you could inject it into the muscle and it stayed in the muscle where you injected it. Didn't go throughout the whole body. And they did a clinical trial, where, you know, two-part clinical trial. Some people got it injected in their biceps and some in their TA. So some in your arm, some in your lower leg. And those are the two different groups. These were FSHD subjects. Some of you may have participated in it. And then a placebo-controlled. So randomized placebo-controlled. Some people got nothing and went through. And this was the first real... This may have been the first real FSHD clinical trial, frankly, for anything.
Yeah,
was powered for FSHD.
I think it probably was, yeah.
So all props to Acceleron for doing it. You know, it's what you have on the shelf.
Yeah.
Or why not?
Well, why not?
Right. So what happened?
Well...
Hey, it's like being in class.
Most metrics of muscle strength really weren't improved. There were certain metrics of muscle function, which, you know, you and I probably aren't that familiar with. Yeah, we're not physicians. We certainly don't know these things, and we're not patients. We can't tell, you know, whether things are actually working or not. So some metrics were, you know, slightly improved. Most were not. But muscle mass was definitely increased for whatever good that was, you know. So
total muscle volume, fat fraction, contractile muscle volume, you know, all of these things were measured. And what they basically came out, they got some strength and patient reported outcomes, safety. My understanding is it was pretty safe. Overall, you got increased and contractile muscle volume in both the biceps and the TA groups. You decrease the fat fraction in the TA group. I'm reading right from the results of the study. But the key is there were no consistent improvements in functional or patient reporter outcome measures in either group. And there are no real adverse effects. Well, the adverse effects were mild injection site reactions. But essentially, bigger muscles, not better.
Right.
That's been the history of myostatin inhibition.
Yep, that's been pretty consistent throughout the trials.
So the question is, why are we going down this path again?
Good question.
Well, now that's what I'm asking. Why are we going down this path again? I don't know, actually. So, the key is, so the myostatin, the pathway regulating muscle growth, myostatin pathway, there are many targets you can, and there are many different ways you can block. And I think the mentality is, you know, I just can't get away from this idea that if you just do it right, you know, whether it's blocking a certain receptor, blocking this signaling molecule, or block that signaling molecule, you just need the right special combination. And if you just got the right thing, then it'll work.
Scientifically, I just don't understand that.
I don't either. But then again, we also don't know the details. It's proprietary details.
True.
But it is going to be different from the ACE-83. This is going to be, it's a 52-week trial. It's going to be a subcutaneous injection every 4 weeks for 52 weeks. It actually says you're going to be in the trial for about 2.5 years, which means you're not going to be in anyone else's trial while you're on this, but whatever.
Jeez.
It's called the is this how you spell maneuver?
Maneuver.
Maneuver?
Looks about right.
They're like Swiss or something. Right? I don't know if that, I honestly, I don't know if that's how you spell maneuver, but that's how they, anyway, that's what it's called, the maneuver trial. and very close to what it may actually be.
Optimistic.
But anyway, now I thought one of the things that kind of surprised me, I got to say, and one of the reasons is because I've mentioned this before on the podcast. There was an outstanding summary of the history of myostatin inhibitions written by Dr. Catherine Wagner, who is a neurologist. And some of you may know her. She had run the Kennedy Krieger clinic in Maryland and Baltimore, ran a lot of FSHD trials. She's part of the Wellstone we were on. She, left that position, is now head of Roche. Somewhere very high up on Roche Neuromuscular Diseases. I'm not sure exact title, but I moved to Switzerland and is, at Roche. And she had written a really outstanding article about the failed promise of myostatin inhibition.
Yeah.
And all the problems with it.
Yep. Yeah, it was a very fair assessment.
Yeah, here she is now running her company, is actually doing another. So it's not like they're unfamiliar with it. So maybe there is something about this. I don't know. I still I'm concerned because the outcome measure that they're looking at, right, is increased muscle mass and volume, right? Not functionality.
Right, because that's the thing they know they can get. Definitely increases muscle mass.
So if you look at, you go and you look and you say, okay, what are the outcome measures going to be? What are the endpoints? So it says the main clinical endpoints are how this works in the body compared to placebo as measured using MRI scans of the thigh muscles after 52 weeks. And they're going to be looking at safety compared to placebo, any side effects by the participants, other endpoints that are going to be assessed, again, MRI of other muscles, just generally what happens to your body and also the immune system. So I'm actually, it doesn't appear they're looking at anything to do with strength whatsoever.
Yeah, that is very interesting. They're not even, is MRI going to assess muscle mass? It's a strange thing.
Well, you can't know. So depending on how you do your MRI, you can look at fat depending on who, there's different companies that do, so it's not clear exactly who's doing the muscle assessment, because you can measure fat fraction, contractile muscle volume. There's a number of things you can do, but there's no, and again, this is right off the Roche website, the Roche clinical trial website. So this is what's out there, and that's all we know what's going on. It seems that it doesn't look like they're measuring strength or function.
Right, at all. They've probably given up on that.
So then it gets to something, you and I were talking a little bit beforehand. It's like one of the things from Catherine's review is she mentions potentially using this as a combinatorial therapy.
Right, which, seems like a very reasonable suggestion. She acknowledges that you really have to cure the primary defect in whatever muscle disease you're studying for this to, have a hope of helping. But, again, if larger muscles don't produce more strength, even in healthy people,
Well, there's no healthy people in this. 100% FSHD.
Yeah. You would think that would be something that should have been done, though. What are the effects of myostatin inhibition
of this
in healthy
drug,
volunteers?
Right. This is called RO7204239. Rolls off the tongue.
People with normal, healthy muscles, if they take this, do they have improvements in muscle strength, muscle function? If that were true, if we had evidence of that, then I'd be very optimistic about using this as a combinatorial therapy.
But to what it says the purpose of this study is to evaluate the pharmacodynamics, safety, tolerability, pharmacokinetics, PKPD, and efficacy of our whatever. And so this is a human monoclonal antibody and evidently binds to myostatin. So it is it's a different, it's not blocking receptor binding exactly, in ambulant adult patients with FSHD. So it's a very directed sort of thing.
Phase 2 trial.
But it's phase 2 because you have patients. Phase 1 is healthy.
Yeah, that's right. So they must have done this in healthy.
Well, but that's all healthy is tox.
Right.
Phase 1 is tox, not efficacy.
Still, there's a lot of information you could get other than tox.
Well, they must have.
Help.
Maybe we're just not privy to that.
Yeah.
But the point is that this also, though, if you think about it, they're not necessarily, this could actually, maybe this is a very clever idea, though, in the sense that, one how we just said, it's not going to work. But maybe it is the long long vision. What is it? Long vision? Is that what, whatever you call it?
Yeah, the long view.
Long view, long game, whatever.
Yeah.
But the idea is that, you know, this overall, they're saying it's a 2.5 year trial. If 2.5 years from now, the feeling is that whether it's antisense or gene therapy or lysmapimod, that something has, you know, shut down DUX4 and FSHD, they're going to be ready with this to come as a combinational therapy.
Well, in all the trials so far, it's been very safe. You know, and yeah, this is a different method, different drug, but
they don't, I mean, they don't say it, but that could be the thought process. Why wait until, so that's the idea. So yeah, sure. On its own, it's unlikely, or at least the history has said on its own, you're unlikely to get stronger muscles with any neuromuscular disease with this type of treatment.
Yeah.
But maybe they're just thinking, hey, once someone else has got this cured, hey, here we are for the combination and build it up. So maybe, I mean, I don't know that, but that's a possibility. I mean, these are smart people running the trial, so they're aware of
the history. Yeah, they're aware of the history for sure. Yeah.
Okay. So, so, you know, maybe that's really all it is. It's, and again, we were not privy. I don't consult for them. Trust me, they would never ask my opinion on anything. Because I tend to give my opinion.
People don't like that.
I just saw there was a great quote the other day from Thomas Sowell, right? That was, you know, if you want to help other people, you tell them the truth. If you want to help yourself, you tell them what they want to hear.
That's right. That's excellent advice.
That's absolutely the truth, right?
That's right.
And so we're not good at
helping ourselves.
Helping ourselves. But anyway, but that's the point. I think the point is, so why aren't they looking at muscle? The question is, why aren't they? So how is it different? It's going to be a systemic treatment that's not localized. Okay. So it's not going to be, that's how it's different from ACE-83, number one. Number two, it is a different actual molecule. This is binding directly to myostatin itself. It's a monoclonal antibody. It hasn't been used. So it's totally different. It's affecting a different part of the pathway. That's another way it's different. So not IM, not CYP3. And why are they looking at muscle volume and muscle MRI versus strength? Perhaps they already know that this is not going to improve strength, so that would be a failed clinical trial endpoint.
Yep.
So just kind of almost like acknowledging that.
Yeah, I think so.
Okay. And so again, now what, you know, I know you guys don't, you know, maybe some people want to look better, but I think you'd rather have functionality, and actually functionality can come with looking better. I don't know. I think y'all are beautiful anyway. I mean, really, seriously, I mean, some strikingly beautiful FSHDers out there, men and women.
You're going to get in trouble.
I know.
We're not naming names.
All of them. Man. Everybody. You know,
man.
Oh man. But maybe they're thinking long term, this sets you up for combination therapy. Because I think we all agree that stopping DUX4 is the key. However, the end result might be you just don't get any worse. And this might be a way to jumpstart the system to help you get better.
Yeah.
Right? One
that
of the ways.
Hope. Right.
Okay.
Right.
So maybe, and again, that'd be a tough thing. You can't really run a trial saying that the end game is to use this as a combination. I mean, I'm not even sure you can get that through FDA. So they're really looking at safety, PK, PD, all the things, characterize the drug. It's in FSH patients. And then, and we'll see from there.
Yeah.
I'm willing to bet that they meet their endpoints.
Oh yeah. I think that's how the endpoints were designed.
Yeah. Well, that's another story. That's another.
To be met.
All right, moving on. Next question. It says, apologies ahead of time for bringing up melatonin again. No worries, man. You know, new information comes out. But there was more information noted in a recent presentation from Ohio State. You know, and then I get this screenshot and about small molecule induction of microRNA 675 by Dr. Saad, and I guess I don't know if he's independent or not, but from the Harper Lab. And, I previously talked about this, that it's an issue of dosing. So the idea is, so it says Dr. Saad was able to get a mouse to show increased expression of miR-675 by oral dosing of melatonin. They got a picture of him cramming melatonin down this mouse's throat. And isn't it reasonable? So that was at 1.5 mg per kg every day. So isn't it reasonable that a human could eat, you know, that 60 mg per day of melatonin and get a similar anti-DUX4 effect. So I'd love to hear your thoughts on this. So the history of this is, so, you know, the Harper Lab at Ohio State, they're essentially an antisense gene therapy lab. Basically, Scott is, they take, they use AAV to deliver a cargo that expresses an antisense to whatever gene of interest they want to knock down, right? Works very well in mice and cells. It is fundamentally different than avidity and dyne and the antisense molecules that are synthetically engineered and then injected into you every few weeks. And like the avidity trial, that's an antisense trial, but not what we can consider traditional gene therapy. That's a biological antisense, but it's the same general idea that the gene therapy cargo from a single shot injection into a person will systemically deliver this piece of DNA that will now express the antisense in theory forever in whatever cells get infected, right? That's kind of the idea. So instead of having to go back to the doc and get injected every few months, like you're going to with avidity or dyne or Miracule, you have the single shot gene therapy and the gene makes the antisense. Okay. So fundamentally the same thing. The idea, if you have an antisense molecule targeting DUX4, you would knock down DUX4, right? That's the idea. And Scott has shown through other work and other molecules, this works very well in his mouse model. He started a company, Armatus something, and they're trying to go to clinic with that. This is the same idea. And however, one of the things that they were doing in the lab a few years ago is looking for new microRNAs. Remember we met with them in San Diego and discussed this project?
Yeah, that was quite a few
like
years
six
ago.
Or seven or eight years ago or something like that, when the FSH meeting was in San Diego. We met with them and talked about this. And so this thing, miR-675, is a natural microRNA encoded in everybody's body. It's in the H19 gene, which is an imprinted gene. And it actually can target the DUX4 mRNA and in the lab shut down DUX4 protein expression. So it's a so the other thing, the original things that Lindsay Wallace developed in Scott's lab were engineered sequences that they made in the lab, they designed to target the DUX4 mRNA, and that's kind of their lead program. This from Dr. Saad is a natural one in your body. So, recently, what they showed, I'm just bringing Chris up to date on this as well. So, you know, to get it kind of, recently what they showed is that you could add melatonin to FSHD cells and you can induce expression of this miR-675, miR is microRNA 675, and this would lead to the reduction of DUX4, right? And so this made everybody go out and buy tons of melatonin and say they're going to pound melatonin and cure FSHD. That's kind of what they're telling people. Similar to the Biberdine thing or whatever. That, Another, you know, the cure is out there. We just got to find it. If you have enough melatonin, you're going to do this. And so the question, and I basically had said, well, if you go through all the math on their in vitro studies and you go through a number of things, you know, you're not going to cure FSHD with melatonin. Evidently, these guys are still thinking you are. So, which is fine. But so you're looking at the data for the, I mean, this day they have a little bit of the data here. This is, I guess, a screenshot taken from one of the presentation. But just conceptually, let's just break this down for a second.
Yeah, let's do that.
Okay. What do you think about gene therapy, microRNA in general as an approach for FSHD? Targeting DUX4.
Well, you've got all the problems associated with gene therapy.
which is delivery and then delivery, a viral viral delivery. Yeah.
All the things we have to worry about with CRISPR.
Yeah, everybody. So there's certain things.
People who, you know, treatments rely on gene therapy.
On the other hand, it's a one-shot treatment.
It's a one-shot treatment. That's the advantage. Boy. Yeah, delivery is a huge one.
Specificity.
Specificity. But, you know, that's the case whether it's delivered by gene therapy or not. I mean, do we know what miR-675, as you pointed out, is a naturally occurring microRNA? What else does it target?
Well, now that is one of the things I had mentioned in the previous podcast. And the question is, so it's one thing if you are introducing a synthetic engineered molecule. Now, so first off, remember, DUX4 is not expressed in healthy muscle. There is no reason that you would have any natural system to shut down DUX4,
right,
because it is already shut down naturally,
right,
through epigenetic repression after early embryonic development. So the normal healthy state is your cells are set up already for no DUX4 expression. So right, you don't have some sort of system whose job it is to do this.
Right.
Okay. So we already know the job of any naturally occurring microRNA is not to shut down DUX4.
Right.
It must do something.
What does it do? Why right, do we have it? Why do we express it?
So that's number one.
Right.
Okay. So that's a good question. So I looked it up.
All right.
What does it do? Well, it turns out, again, this is a natural microRNA that is upregulated in osteoarthritic cartilage, okay? And it's actually co-regulated with the collagen 2A1 gene. The miR-675 upregulates collagen 2A1 and through an unknown mechanism, and that this is can lead to or is associated with osteoarthritis.
Hmm.
Okay, so first off, in boosting levels, this is just an indication, just an example.
Yeah.
That
may not be the best thing.
Okay, what else does it do? So miR-675 overexpression reduces proliferation in stem cells. Okay. So it knocks down proliferation. And actually, if you knock out miR-675, cells just kind of grow continually. So increasing its expression suppresses stem cell proliferation. So in a disease where you need to regenerate muscle, you might not want to overexpress something that is going to shut down cell proliferation.
Yeah.
The natural function of this microRNA appears to be to regulate cell proliferation of some, so at least stem cells is what this is. I mean, this is just pulling off some, I haven't really gone deep into it. And that overexpression of this is associated with some other pathological conditions.
Yeah.
So overexpressing it as a treatment might not be a great idea.
Might not be great. You need your satellite cells, which are a type of stem cell, muscle resident stem cells, to proliferate and fuse to actual muscle fibers.
So that's the first thing. So the first thing is that it's normal levels are regular. So now we get to the second part, the induction of it. Okay. So, and again, you know, I always get in trouble for this because it's not, you know, I know this is actually why I don't go to the FSHD research meeting, you know, there's going to be going on next week in Milan, Italy, because, you know, you need to evidently, I guess Mark Stone wanted to hang out in Milan for a week with 12 of his friends.
Why not?
Yeah. I understand they can all show up in one car though. They only need one car.
We're going down for that.
Sorry. But
maybe no one will get that.
But the reason I don't go to these meetings anymore and our lab doesn't attend anymore is because you're not allowed to have these discussions.
Yeah.
Because what's going to happen is because how dare you criticize this work? I'm not really criticizing it. I'm just raising, I think, legitimate
scientific
questions.
Yeah, exactly.
That I think should be addressed in a discussion. And I used to go to the meeting and ask these types of questions and everyone would get mad at me. So why are you attacking so-and-so?
You're not allowed to ask critical questions.
So if you're asking well, you know, this doesn't really make sense. You know, boy, it looks like overexpression of this might not be a good idea. I mean, sure, if you overexpress it in your cells and you assay DUX4 and it goes down, that looks good. And if you have your kind of, they have that mouse model, they do this. Again, if you do everything artificial in the lab, you can get grants and you can publish papers, you can graduate students, make it look good. But in the context of an actual curing the disease or treating the disease, boy, this doesn't sound like a great idea. Could you please address that? Oh my God, everyone's just getting mad at you. You're not allowed to ask those questions. And this kind of gets to where we, you know, so I'm, maybe they have the answers to these, but these are what I would want to know the answers
yeah,
to.
Yeah, I
want to
know what the off-target effects are, what the specificity is,
you know,
and
what
really is the effect of on DUX4 here?
Well, so that's the thing. So all they're showing, well, okay, that's because that's just a mouse, right? I mean, again, I'm only looking at the presentations. I didn't see this thing that was presented. But what they're showing is that melatonin, you can orally administer melatonin and increase from, it goes from, this goes from 0.4. It looks like you can twofold increase in the level of this microRNA with melatonin.
With 3 milligrams per kilogram.
Okay. So you go from whatever the normal level is and you double it.
Right. So what is the effect of this?
So now if you think about DUX4 in FSHD, right? And I'm not going to argue with any of this data other than it's all over the map. And again, it looks like widely variable, let's just say.
As microRNAs
tend to be. And the induction is widely variable. But if you do enough samples, you eventually get statistical significance. So at 3 mgs per kg, they double it, right? They get a twofold increase. Let's think about levels of DUX4 in an FSHD cell.
Yeah.
You take a healthy cell and level of DUX4 on a cell-by-cell basis, okay, basically zero. And then you take a DUX4 expressing cell and expression level is, what, 10,000 times? You know, I guess you go against zero, but huge amount of DUX4, right? Versus, okay. So you have the baseline that's already there. So the baseline level of this microRNA in all the cells can be doubled with melatonin.
Mm-hmm.
DUX4 levels in FS, so that's the normal level. So we already know that has no effect whatsoever, because if it had an effect, you wouldn't get FSHD because DUX4 would be suppressed. Right. I mean, if the normal baseline levels of this had any effect on DUX4, you
right.
So doubling its levels.
Does that help?
Is that enough to completely wipe out?
Well, or to lower DUX4.
To lower DUX4 at all.
At all. Yeah. That's
that would be the actual question.
Right.
Right. So you could address that in the lab and say, if you go into the lab and you say, okay, what are the levels of my FSHD cell culture, microRNA 675.
Mm-hmm.
This would be my class now, the class. Design an experiment to test this. Okay, design an experiment to test this.
Now, treat the cells with melatonin at various doses and it's typical small molecule.
Well, no. Okay, you got a B. I understand where you're going, but you didn't finish the thought.
And then look at DUX4 levels.
But they've done it. But that's
primary FSHD muscle cells and culture.
So they've done that and they show, okay, that's where they started actually.
Yeah. So you want to go back to that? What do you?
No, because the problem there was they put on a buttload of melatonin and then they also put on, it's the same thing with berberidine, right? You had to put on so much in order to get the effect. But that's, you know, the thing to remember, let me interrupt you. Interrupt that thought. Don't roll your eyes at me. You see,
I'll
that?
Do whatever I want.
You see what she rolled her eyes at me.
I am a guest on this podcast.
It was a privilege. So think about this now. So the difference in cell culture is you don't have to go through the gut, right? The whole point of the mouse experiment is they're showing that oral administration of melatonin can induce this microRNA. So to me, now you go back to the cells and what you've shown is you can only, you know, they're pumping this mouse full of melatonin and they get a twofold increase.
Right.
So now you go back to your cell cultures and say, we are going to only give a twofold increase
In
the microRNA. Not with melatonin, just artificially.
Yeah.
There's a twofold increase have any effect whatsoever.
Yes, that is what I would do. But you asked about a melatonin experiment.
No, I didn't. I just asked, how do you go to the next step? And to me, it's just...
After this, absolutely. Yeah. The question is, does a twofold increase in miR-675 have any effect on DUX4 expression?
Because now you know the level you can get in a mouse. So you start off and you say, if we got a bazillion fold level,
we
can shut it down. You go to the mouse, say we can get a twofold. Now you go back to the cells and say, does this have any effect whatsoever?
That's right. Because there's no way of correlating melatonin levels
In
cells with versus...
Right. That was my original was my original comment when we covered this original. My original comment when we covered this originally was that I need your editing. Well, but that was kind of the, you know, that it says in preparation. So I guess this will be published. And so we'll see what the...
And also, I would add to that, what does a twofold increase in miR-675 do to off targets? What are the effects on global gene expression? That's equally important.
And
you can address that in the exact same experiment.
And that's exactly right. What does this do to all the other cells? You do an RNA, a global RNA-seq.
Let's look
genome-wide on the expression.
Look at all those collagen genes. Are they going up a lot? And is that a problem?
Well, but also, but that's... You know, you also might want to look at that. Now, again, in the mouse, you know, because it's a sequence-based, so it doesn't give you some, you know, you'd want to, I guess, look at a primate cells. Because the question also then becomes about non-muscle cells, because invariably the delivery of the gene therapy is going to go to non-muscle cells.
It's going to go to other
cells.
Tissues. That's exactly right.
Right. And so you're going to be expressing this like crazy in these other cells and doing it forever. That's and besides the other... So, but this isn't a gene. I mixed two things. This is not a proposal to do this as a gene therapy. That's what his other thing is. This is a proposal to just go pound melatonin.
Right. And you can see where that's attractive to people. It's available. It's easy.
So what happens if you just pound melatonin? If you just start pounding melatonin, apart from going broke,
how much do people generally take for sleep deficiency?
Actually, I don't know.
Because the question here, is it reasonable that a human of 90 kilograms could dose roughly 60 milligrams per day of melatonin? So how does 60 milligrams per day compare to what people are, you know, recommended to take for the normal indication?
All right. So looking online, it says bodies naturally produce an estimated
10 to 80 micrograms.
Micrograms of melatonin. That's your natural amount.
60 milligrams per day sounded like a ridiculous amount, a dangerous amount of anything. Wow. Doesn't seem like a good idea.
So it says there's actually little to no evidence that melatonin works as an effective sleep aid for insomnia. However, it can actually affect circadian rhythms. Okay, the timing of your sleep. Okay, so there we go. So 10 milli...
Can you overdose on melatonin?
So the question is, though, so if you normally make micrograms, now we're milligram is 10,
thousands.
Is 1,000 times more.
That's right.
Okay, 1,000 times more. And so the question is, so could you, and so yes, you can technically overdose on melatonin. Okay, so could you? So how much do you need? It's
sleepiness, dizziness. Did you see those... side effects, and
that's
with people not doing 1,000-fold extra.
We're just looking online.
Upset stomach, diarrhea, lethargy, low blood pressure, confusion. Now times that by 1,000.
So it is advised by this a medical doctor that we're found online. No, I don't know. Maybe we're doing this, you know, just looking online, being our own medical doctors. But online it says it's advised adults should not take more than 5 milligrams a night without talking to their doctor. Side effects can also be chronic headaches, high blood pressure, vomiting, nausea, increased hair loss as melatonin overdose. So 5 mg is what they're saying is the max.
And maybe osteoarthritis.
And osteoarthritis.
miR-675 upregulation.
So now we're talking about, you know, is it reasonable that 60 mg per day? So now you're saying 10 times more.
So based
on the math of this.
Yeah.
Okay. To double the level of miR-675. Now, again, this is going, I think that the actual math on dosing, if I'm not mistaken, mouse to human, to get this amount, 1.5 mg per kg every day. And that's actually what he did. I think he actually knew that. Yeah, so no, he didn't actually. So, okay, so let's do the math. All right, so let's look at the dosing then. So now the question is, getting back to the question is, So, to get double the amount, you need 3 mg per kg, right? So you need 3 mg per kg in the mouse double the level of mirror 675. Okay. So if you are a 90 kilogram person, you know, how much do you need? So we would say nine. So you'd say 3 times 90, you need 270 megs, but you're not a mouse. And so if we go to our conversion table and you say, now the thing about it is you can make rough conversions and say that, you know, larger animals have lower metabolic rates, physiological processes of larger animals are slower. And one of the things about mice that makes them not a great model is they have insanely high metabolism. Yeah. They turn over things. So there are these tables to say what is the human equivalent dose compared to mouse? And so you take the mouse dose and you multiply it by 0.081 or you divide it by 12.3. It doesn't really matter which way you go. And you come up with a dose for someone that's 90 kilograms of 21.87 milligrams of melatonin you would need to take.
Okay. And the clinically recommended dose was
5.
Five. So we're talking 4 times that amount.
So they said recommended do not
exceed 5 milligrams a day.
So you're right. more than four times over what's considered the highest dose recommended.
Yeah.
To get double the level of mirror 675,
which may or may not have any useful effect on DUX4 expression. Well,
you're more polite than I. It is highly unlikely to have a high enough level
to do anything
to shut down
through FSHD
pathological levels of DUX4
in your
muscles.
Yep.
Not to mention the effect it will have on your circadian rhythm. I mean, you time your, because that's the other thing about melatonin, right? You have normal melatonin levels that cycle through the day.
And if you want to screw yourself up, mess up your circadian rhythm. Those studies are extremely well done. Very convincing.
So you're going to totally wipe out circadian rhythm, totally do a lot of things. Because the other thing about it is, you're inducing this. So maybe that's what you need. Maybe the idea is you pulse it. You make some mirror. Now, these things, microRNAs are often very stable. That's another thing that I guess could be addressed is how stable are these things.
How dynamic, how stable.
It's not like you have to pump, so they're doing this with this mouse. It says the dosing on the mouse was every other day for 2 weeks. So if maybe you just take it every other day, which would be kind of weird. Every other day you're pounding melatonin. What would that do to your circadian rhythms?
God only knows.
I don't know, man.
But you mess with your circadian rhythms, it increases obesity, cancer, heart disease, all kinds of problems.
And lifespan goes down.
That's right. And those are very convincing and frightening studies.
So we're just right. These are my concerns, your concerns as well.
Absolutely.
Our concerns when we see this, as thinking about using this as a patient to self-medicate. Does this mean that this is an idiotic idea and worth it? No, we're not saying that. We're just saying these are the concerns.
Yep.
And so that would be a discussion that I think would be good to have to say, okay, how do you, is this really a viable thing or is this butterfly collecting?
Yeah.
And I would, if I review, I guarantee you, I am an excluded reviewer anytime. I haven't had a paper from Scott in 10 years, which is fine. It doesn't bother me. But it won't get asked at these quiet things, and again, it's the same sort of thing with berberine, right?
Yeah.
A global G quadruplex binder.
Probably not a great thing.
If you could take enough, what would it do?
Right.
So these are the things. So, I don't want to always be like negative and say,
we have to be. It wouldn't be right.
It's not negative. It's just being real.
Realistic. Can't be a proponent of these things. We can't say go out and overdose yourself on these things just because it's
realistic.
Easy.
I don't see any way this has any benefit for FSHD whatsoever in my, and you know what? Convince me that I'm wrong. And I would be thrilled if it turned out
the convincing data.
That's right. If you can just go pop a few melatonin pills every few days, you cured FSHD, I will be the first person to congratulate.
We will retire early.
Oh, absolutely, man. but I just, based on just the math and everything,
based on the science, it looks based like on the available type of data, thing, it is very,
You can rig the system to work in cell culture.
Yep.
You can rig the system to work in mice models and do this all. Everything's legitimate science, but the path to clinic is
just not there.
Is over a cliff, man, as far as I can tell.
Yeah.
That's my opinion. That's opinion. Again, we don't have a privy to all the.
Nope.
I just conceptually.
But if you want our opinion, there it is.
That's the opinion. All right. All right. That's been okay. We've got a couple of questions. We've got two more to go, but take a little break for some of the Queen and Tina Turner. Classic 1980s. You said you hadn't seen Thunderdome yet?
No, I have. I have.
You have seen Thunderdome?
Yeah. I just don't remember movie plots very well. Okay. They're not like books, you know? They don't stick in your head.
They're exactly like books. What are you talking about? You know, so I do have, you know, I told him I have Peter's list now. You know, I talk about foundations, but, oh, you know, we got movies. So favorite 80s movie. Oh, you're like 10 years younger than me, though, aren't you?
Seven?
Really?
Yeah.
Okay. But not really a child of the 80s. You're more of a 90s child, aren't you?
I guess.
Yeah. Give me a couple of movies. Give us a couple. What are some
Big
Koreas?
Trouble in Little China?
Big Trouble in Little China.
It's probably been erased. I don't know.
Which actually takes place in Chinatown. Right?
It does, yeah.
Actually, that's right. That probably has been erased.
My mom hates that movie, and we like to watch it to annoy her.
We watch it like every Christmas.
Three Amigos.
Another family favorite.
Princess Bride, absolutely.
Absolutely.
And the book is just as good, if not better.
It's a book?
Oh, yeah.
Seriously? So
William Goldman. Wait
a minute. Princess
Bride. The
reason
the movie is so good is because they didn't mess with the book.
So it's Peter Falk reading the book that's the actual book that they make into the movie.
It's very confusing, but yes.
Wait, we don't have enough time.
Moving on.
Okay, Princess Bride, yeah, absolutely. Three Amigos, favorite line from Three Amigos?
Oh boy, so many. It's a sweater is right up there.
It's a sweater.
El Guapo's birthday. That was a big day.
Great time.
Middle of the desert. It's 120 degrees out, and they give him a sweater, a homemade sweater.
I think my favorite scene is when they when he shoots the invisible horseman.
Oh yeah, you do like that. Yeah, you brought that up many times.
Let me say, I don't know. There's probably a lot of lines. I've told them that we did the when I sang part of our musical group No Jerks in 1987 when we did
the
Gong Show.
Did you do Dear Little Buttercup?
No. It wasn't. It was I'm a Little Teacup.
Oh, right.
I'm a Little Teacup. We sang on stage at the DeVilbiss High
School.
After you
put your cigarettes out and tossed them into the crowd.
Gong Show, and then we did the Three Amigos little dance at the end.
You had your slap on tattoos.
Yeah, it was pretty good. No, that was good. Okay, I'll go with those movies. Good movies. Those are Carice's list movies. I went a little more highbrow.
Off the top of my head. Highbrow, yeah.
Cinema Paradiso, Emerald Forest, a couple of my favorites from the 80s, Never Ending Story.
Never Ending Story. You know, that thing in the cave scared the crap out of us. Man, that was a scary creature.
I never saw the subsequent ones. And
no, I didn't either.
Okay, read it.
Atreyu. Anyway, all right, moving
back. Back to the stories. Okay, we got two more questions we're going to do because we talked too much. So it says, okay, here we go. One of the areas that I struggle with in regard to trials is measuring of efficacy. There isn't a model that can predict how or when those of us affected will have a step drop in muscle and strength loss, which is true, basically saying it's pretty hard to predict the natural course of disease in people with FSHD, unlike other neuromuscular diseases.
Right.
So it says, I've heard you comment on various episodes about the measures of success of recent clinical trials have employed. In my opinion, what is the world's best practice for measuring efficacy in trials? All right. So brings up a couple of excellent points. Again, we got a brilliant, I believe we're getting a well-educated, thoughtful audience.
Oh, yeah. It's a great question.
Yeah. It's a fantastic question. We know the fulcrum. So we know ACE-83 trial that we talked about briefly. They got increased muscle mass, increased muscle volume, but did not get increased muscle strength and function, right? So they measured that.
Yep.
I think that's an important thing to measure is muscle strength and function. Then the losmapimod trial, which is a very different mode of action. That is, presumably, losmapimod represses DUX4 gene expression, and they're measure of efficacy was whether or not they actually repressed DUX4 gene expression.
Yep.
And they were unable to detect that.
That's right.
Okay. So now the new measure of efficacy for a drug who is supposed to shut down DUX4 gene expression is they're not going to look at shutting down DUX4 gene expression.
Yep.
Instead, they're looking at reachable workspace.
Yep.
Okay. The myostatin inhibition trial we just talked about from Roche, they are going to really look at really pharmacodynamics, safety, and tolerability. But the one measurable metric is going to be MRI.
Right.
MRI of muscle, composition, it looks like, which is, and now you're going to have Dyne or Avidity's in trial now, and they're going to be looking at a reachable workspace, right? And presumably that seems where people are kind of going. And some, they're going to be doing MRI as well, but I think their primary outcome measures reachable workspace. So I think what Jason is asking is, what do we think of all of this? And what would we do if it was up to us? So what do you think?
Well, I think for a DUX4 targeted therapy, you really have to look at DUX4 activity, a direct measure of it. And if your drug is not doing that, then it's either, and it's working, you know, according to some other metric, then it's either having its effects via some unknown DUX4 independent pathway, which is highly unlikely, but possible.
Well, it depends on the...
Or the metric itself that you're using for success doesn't really mean much, you know? So that's my opinion.
Well, there's a couple of things there, because it does depend on the mode of action of your molecule.
Sure.
So if you've got the avidity synthetic antisense that is designed to target DUX4.
Yep.
And you've done all the experimental things.
Yep.
The odds of that actually functioning independent of DUX4 are probably pretty slim.
Low. Yeah.
Now, if you have losmapimod, which is an inhibitor
that's
of
true.
P38.
If there's a giant black box between your drug and its intended target, anything could happen.
So that's a good inhibition point. Of P38.
Yeah.
That somehow
there's
leads
some unknown
to
mechanism,
repression of DUX4.
Leads to lower DUX4.
One could very easily, it is well documented in the literature that inhibition of P38
has a lot of effects on muscle proliferation,
health,
differentiation,
regeneration.
Survival, regeneration, all these metrics of, you know, muscle.
So now in that case, you could imagine, in fact, there is a study that was put out using the MDX mice, which are a Duchenne muscular dystrophy mouse, mm-hmm. that does not express DUX4. Mice don't have DUX4. They're a dystrophic model that showed that P38 inhibition provided benefit to that dystrophic model short term. Right?
Yeah.
And you remember that paper, right? Mm-hmm. And so there's in Human Molecular Genetics, can't remember quite the first author, but Willett et al. In Human Molecular Genetics a few years ago. And so it has been shown that P38 inhibition can have short-term benefit on a dystrophic muscle environment completely independent of
DUX4. Right.
So getting back to what you said.
So if you look short term.
So you can be sued just like me.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. We're going down together.
Well, you know, these are just going down the science. Actually, you know, hopefully people understand that, you know, we are actually rooting for all of these to succeed.
Oh, yeah.
So we can retire and go fishing.
Even if it's blind faith.
You know, well, I mean, you know, but, you know, our job is to evaluate the science,
yeah.
not inflate stock price.
That's right. And not give people false hope for things that could be potentially
right.
damaging.
We're telling you how it is without being a cheerleader or being against anything.
Yeah.
Right? And I'm more than happy to tell you all the issues with our therapeutic approaches, too. All the positives and negatives.
Oh, yeah. We published them.
Yes, we have.
Read our review.
Right. What review is that?
Therapeutic strategies. What will it take to get to the clinic? I mean, we really wanted to provide a different kind of review. Because if you read the reviews about... FSHD, you know, sort of in the past, and other diseases too. They read like, you know, they're book reports of the field,
yeah.
and they make it sound like the disease has been cured in this model and that model, all animal models and cultured cells. I mean, my tonic was cured in mice, and
that's been cured many times,
many times, and the
just
same thing with Duchenne, you know. And so they, you know, as a patient or a patient or just someone outsider to the field, you would read these reviews and think, wow, every disease on earth has been cured. And it's not true. You know, most diseases are at some point,
especially neuromuscular diseases,
in the therapeutic pipeline, and it becomes very difficult. So people understandably frustrated.
Nobody...
What is the disconnect between, you know, what's been done in the lab and the translation to the clinic? Why isn't it so straightforward? And so we wanted to ask those hard questions and actually give you guys some answers.
This is published in the Journal of Personalized Medicine. It is free online. Look up Carice Hameda, FSHD therapeutic approaches, what will it take to clinic?
Yeah, freely available.
It is freely available.
Yeah.
It's a free download. You can check it out. Google it. But the reason people don't, you know, think about some of the advice when everyone was coming down on me earlier this year about my podcast, everyone meaning people in the field, scientists coming down on me for the podcast. The reason they were coming down was not because they disagreed with the content. They said, you shouldn't say these things.
All right.
Because, you know, don't tell people what's going on, because it'll
damage your career.
You know, I was advised that what I should do is say, will saying this help me or hurt me?
And the answer to that is, if it's going to hurt you, you say nothing. You come up with very clever ways of saying nothing. And that just seems like a waste of time.
And there are people who do that. They answer your questions and tell you about it. So every, you know, we're in Lake Wobegon, okay? Everybody's above average. You know, everything's going to work. Everybody's great. Every project is fantastic.
What have we learned?
This paper is great. Nothing. That paper is great. This study is great. Everybody's great. And we're all going to just get along and move along.
Yeah.
And I just believe in critical evaluation of the data. Yeah. And
being honest about the reality.
And quite honestly, I have the researchers too.
Yeah.
you know, in my opinions. But I think, you know, the reason I put this on the podcast, I mean, this isn't, you know, so everyone else does all this stuff behind everyone's back and in the back rooms and at the bar.
Yeah, water cooler talk.
In fact, there's even a criticism of this. They say, oh, this sounds like we're all just sitting around the bar having a drink. And this is actually, other researchers have said this to me. They said, this is how we talk when we're at the bar. You can't put this on the podcast.
So you're hearing our bar talk.
So let me tell you.
You should hear us when we have a drink.
Interestingly, I said, this is just over. Yeah. Interestingly, I've been told from patients, this is what they like. It sounds like we're at the bar with you guys and you're having a drink. Because again, you know, people do, you know, people are good scientists. I mean, you may sit around and everyone yucks it up at the meeting or whatever, but everyone in the back is like, oh my God, that's the dumbest project I've ever seen in my life, is what people will say when that person's not there.
You could
hear
what's going through everyone's heads as opposed to what they say.
Oh my God, there are little cartoon bubbles over everybody's head. That'd be fantastic. Oh my God.
Which has been...
So this is our cartoon bubble. We're just telling you the truth. We're not knocking, you know, we're just, it's an honest evaluation of what's going on. So when we tell you, that the answer to this question, getting back to the question, honestly, if your drug is supposed to knock down DUX4, I would like to see that you've knocked down DUX4 or its target genes.
Yep, exactly.
And I would like to see it done correctly. There's also always the chance that things aren't necessarily done correctly. Correct is an interesting term. Everyone has their idea of what's correct. So I think that sometimes you have to do the harder, more expensive experiment to know if it's actually working. But I think the gold standard, now that's going to be a muscle biopsy before and after. That kind of sucks.
Yeah.
Honestly, I think if you're targeting DUX4.
This is why we need really good biomarkers.
But right now, if you're targeting DUX4, the Avidity trial is targeting DUX4. The Fulcrum trial, presumably, they claim they're targeting DUX4. I would like to see DUX4, the target gene signature, go away.
Mm-hmm.
And it should.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. I think that what's coming, and maybe not ready for prime time, but very soon, will be whole body MRI.
Yep. I was just thinking that. That's good.
Yeah. So what do you think about that?
Yeah. Yeah. No, I think the data is fantastic. What's been reported so far. And
what we're privy to.
Yeah. What we're privy to, which, you know, maybe can't talk about too much, but yeah, that would be a non-invasive way to really measure the effectiveness of DUX4 targeted therapy.
And so Roche is going to be looking again. Sometimes it's
how
you evaluate your data, right? For your MRI. Now MRI is expensive and that's going to limit the sites that you can do these trials at. And you know, it's going to be hard to do MRI on 380 people or whatever, if that's what you're going to do in a trial, whatever. But, you know, as a measure of muscle health, stopping disease progression systemically over time. And I think that what you'll be able to see is if you have enough muscle, you know, because again, whole body MRI, that you'll see that, you know, maybe some muscles that were starting to go downhill might recover.
Mm-hmm.
You won't have new muscles developing pathology.
Yeah.
And, you know, and so I actually think that whole body, you know, and that should translate into
better muscle function and health.
And health, right. Yeah. So we were just talking about this the other day when people asked us about, you know, a couple percent change in reachable workspace.
Right.
And being told, hey, you know.
Yeah.
And we were talking about this, you know, the idea, how are you going to know your drug works or your therapy works?
Yeah. I mean, if it works, it should be fairly obvious from a patient point of view. You should know whether it's working or not. You shouldn't say to yourself, I feel exactly the same. But they tell me I've got a 0.12% increase in whatever metric. Is that comforting to you? Does that actually change anything about your life?
What you'll see is they'll say, well, there were 40 people on placebo and 40 people on drug, and we got this 1% change between the two groups. therefore, and but
and it's statistically significant. Does that help?
And it's significant to 0.000001.
Is that, yeah, I mean, does that make you feel any better?
You know, but you can point to this person and say they didn't get any better. You can point to this person and say they didn't get any better. And you can point to this, you know, I mean, yeah, it's just kind of a, and I just feel like when we have something that actually works, provides therapeutic benefit,
you won't need to do these fancy statistics and worry about which test to use.
Yeah, you're not going to need a statistician to tell you.
Yeah.
It's, yeah. Yeah. You know my favorite statistician joke, right?
Oh, yeah, I love it. I love that joke. Go ahead. Okay.
I got a credit. I actually heard this from Oliver King.
That's
Oliver
right.
King.
Who is a computational biologist.
He's a I was going to say, you call him a statistician. He'll come get you, man.
That's trivializing him.
He's a mathematician.
That's right.
He's got a PhD in math from Berkeley, I believe.
Yeah, and he told this joke with a straight face probably in a talk he gave, which was fantastic.
Absolutely one of the most valuable members of the FSHD research community that you have never heard of.
Yeah, absolutely.
Because let me tell you, this guy, I mean, he...
But he's on a lot of papers, and
he's on a lot of
so.
Papers. He gets, he's had a little bit of effort on a lot of grants. He's an author, an unheralded author on a lot of grant papers. But he actually
he's brilliant.
Is the one that can really tell you if things are working and understands the science and understands
the statistics. The proper statistical test to use in various situations.
But he also understands how statistics can be manipulated to hide things. And so he told this joke. The one time I saw him talk, he's like, you know, so a physicist, a chemist, and a statistician went hunting. And they're going through the forest. They got their guns loaded. They're going through and they see this big deer. And the chemist lines up and goes and takes a shot really quick, and he misses the deer 3 feet to the left. And the physicist quickly fires again, and he misses 3 feet to the right. And the statistician goes, "Yes, we got him."
From a statistical point of view, he's right.
Statistical point of view, they're having deer for dinner.
The fact is, they're not having deer for dinner.
But it shows you that, you know, what
the limitations,
the limitation in people, you know, but Oliver does a great job. And he writes the soft, and he's way beyond a statistic. I mean, he uses statistics, but he's a computational biologist, mathematician, and he's writing the program for our methylation diagnostic and all these things, does a million things. Anyway, I'm not sure how I got off on that, but you shouldn't need the statistics to tell. I mean, this is even the diagnostics. You see that, right? People will say, "Hey, here's our diagnostic methylation method." We saw this from this group in France, right? And they got, 100 people here and 100 people there, and they saw a statistical difference in methylation. And you say, okay, does this person have FSHD? They don't have a freaking clue because there's so much overlap. But if you do enough people, you can get stuff to be. And the truth is, I believe that when we have a therapy that actually shows benefit,
it will be clear.
And I think you see this in other, you're starting to see this even in Duchenne, right? You see this in some other things, right? And it should be clear and should be sustained.
Yeah.
Okay.
That's right. So, over time.
So I think that, to me, that'll be the gold standard, will be just that we're just going to, I actually don't think that it's going to be a question. But you can't go to the FDA to say, "Hey, it clearly works."
What's your metric for success? Well, it'll be obvious.
It is obvious. But I think that, for things that target DUX4, DUX4
repression.
At this point, the gold standard would be the DUX4 gene signature that came out of the Tapscott lab working with Robbie Tuil and Jeff Statland and those guys.
That's
right. The signature that they have is the key.
That they have.
Well, that they developed.
Yeah, exactly.
The signature that they developed, right? As assayed.
Not other signatures.
Right. And assayed as they would suggest you assay it.
Right.
And I think MRI would be a great thing to have with that.
Yeah, that's coming.
And I think that is going to be developed. And I actually hope that eventually it will displace it. Although, honestly, I'm always going to want to see that the DUX4 goes down. I know it sucks to get a biopsy. We don't have a circulating biomarker yet that's a surrogate, but
there we go. We'll see.
All right. So then the last question we're going to have, my friend Vera says, can you discuss what needs to be done to include pediatrics in your trial for renogenics? Well, we don't like to talk about renogenics too much, but we can talk about pediatric under 18s in the clinical trials. Can you go overseas to receive it sooner rather than later? Again, parents with kids that have FSHD are desperate. They want help now, saying we're 5 years away. They're not. It's especially when you see the kids going down, right? So I think she's asking, could you actually somehow get a treatment earlier by going overseas? And asking a lot of pharmaceutical companies go after myotonic and FSHD, and it looks like myotonic is ahead. How do these diseases compare? And, you know, what do we see our treatment being similar to Zolgensma? And will it be just as expensive? Okay, so a number of things to unpack here. We can start at the bottom and work our way up, actually.
Go ahead.
Gene therapy, one shot, systemic. Now Zolgensma is, going to be your spinal muscular atrophy drug. It's injected into the CNS and single shot. It's, what, $1.5 million? Most of the world's most expensive drug, right? Yep. You got the idea?
Yep.
Costs are going to be coming down for gene therapy in general. The more people have it, the more people amenable to it. Right. So FSHD, but we're still talking gene therapy, going to be $1 million type of drugs.
Yeah, very expensive.
Now, what is this? This sounds brutal, right? What might other drugs cost? Well,
what about a chronic drug people take for their entire lives, you know? How do you compare that to a single
dose?
So if
you have $50,000 a year for your drug that you got to take, which is a number that has been bantered around as a legitimate number that might be out there for these drugs, north of $50,000 a year for drugs that are, you know, have to take continually.
Yeah.
20 years, you got $1 million.
Yep.
Okay. So, and that's maybe even pretty higher
comparable.
Than that. and it may go up, you know.
It's pretty comparable over the long haul.
So that's the first. So cost of gene therapy is expensive. On the other hand, due to the durability of the effect, I think it's going to be cost effective.
And insurance companies are having to deal with these things now, and
payers
considering milestone, you know, payments and things.
Okay,
so we'll see.
So when it comes to kids, though, I think actually, oddly, you know, most of the gene therapy trials going on are actually in kids because they're being done for pediatric diseases, Duchenne muscular dystrophy. Everybody's
on the young side.
All these things right there, that's where that's being tested. So I think that for gene therapy, following Duchenne, there's no reason not to have kids.
Yeah.
A couple caveats.
Mm-hmm.
It's easier to have kids in a trial if that's all you got are kids for the disease, right? SMA will, you know, the SMA trials are on, you know, these kids are one year old and they're getting treatment because that's when you need it. Duchenne, they're 4 and 5, 6 years old. Again, you're trying to treat them before they're severely affected.
Yeah, because it's such a fatal terminal. Yeah.
Yeah. And these are kids
have the death illness.
The prognosis
is very clear cut.
Death in your 20s or 30s.
Yeah.
You know, by now it's somehow they can get, sometimes they can get to 30, but basically early death.
Yeah.
SMA prognosis death, what, by age 2, 3, something like that, without treatment, very early death, right?
Yeah.
So FSHD prognosis is quality of life declines over a long time.
Right.
Okay. So a little bit different. What do you think about having kids for a gene therapy trial?
Yeah, I think for, safety, as long as the treatment is, you know, relatively safe, certainly would be an N of one type of thing.
Do you think it could alleviate some of the problems? I mean, pre-existing antibodies?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. For gene therapy. Yeah, yeah.
Underlying conditions?
No, that's very true. For a single dose treatment, yeah, I bet your pediatric population would have a far, just way fewer exposed to pre-existing neutralizing antibodies, right, against whatever.
I mean, I actually think it's outstanding to go to. I mean,
it could alleviate a lot of problems.
You're going to have less pre-existing. So the key is adeno-associated virus, which is the delivery mechanism, is naturally occurring virus.
Yeah.
People have an immune response against that.
Yep.
Against CAS, potentially from Staph aureus.
And there's ways of dealing with this, you know, with immunosuppression and gene therapy. So it doesn't automatically eliminate you, but it's something that has to be dealt with.
But it's going to be, the older you are, the more
you've been exposed to
things.
The more you've been exposed
to, and the immune response could be more complicated.
It could be more complicated,
again,
more severe.
There's ways to deal with it.
Right. But the kids other, might be a better population.
The other thing about being older is you have underlying conditions. People get diabetes. That's they have heart disease. They have liver disease. They have all sorts of things.
Kids tend to be healthier.
Other
generally.
Than the FSHD, because the thing, all That's these true. Other conditions are the same in the FSHD population as in the general population. Right. You know, you develop things as you get older. And actually, I have in younger, you're going to be healthier, except for the FSHD. And then also, muscle mass and healthy muscle.
Yeah.
And how affected
That's
you
right.
are.
That's yep. right.
The less affected you are, the more healthy muscle you have. If you're going to stop the destruction, the better off you're going to be.
Yeah, no, that's true.
So to me, I'm like... Win.
Yeah.
For having kids, probably, you know, between 12 and 18. I don't know, when do people, like, nowadays, where they have puberty, it's like 6 now? I mean, I don't know, they keep telling me it's going earlier.
It's different
earlier.
In Ohio.
But it's getting earlier, right? I mean, there's just some 10-year-old girl that got pregnant, right? I mean, it's just kind of...
I thought kids are on their phones and not getting pregnant anymore, but
well, but that's
what do
different
I
from being puberty. They're going through puberty on their phones. They're not getting
pregnant from their phones.
Well, the tractor story. Never mind, Seinfeld fans. anyway, so I think, so from a perspective, not a renogenics perspective, but just a general perspective on gene therapy, speaking as a general someone in the field, to me, I actually, also kids are smaller.
Mm-hmm. That's
so
true.
You're dosing smaller,
safer,
it's going to be less effective, cheaper, safer. More muscle to save. Everything about it to
healthier
me
muscle in general
is better. And as far as I know, it's kind of up to the companies to decide.
Yeah, it's really not our call.
but the thing is, that what the companies always say is we don't have kids in clinical trial for FSHD because we have no natural history on kids. I kind of respond and say, who cares?
Yeah. With a disease with such variable progression,
the natural history on
adults
is all over
the place. So how is that an advantage?
So what do you know? You know that they're expressing DUX4 and skeletal muscles. Yeah. You know they're going to get progressively worse over time.
They got FSHD
the longer
genetics.
You wait, the worse they're going to get.
Right.
What natural history do you need?
Hit them early and.
Now again, that's I was going to say you have MRI. I mean, the MRI on a kid can be different than MRI on a once you get past puberty.
I suppose they do have to have symptoms, though. You can't just take
Well, because you got to know if it's going to get better.
Exactly. Yeah,
but these people, normally they're not getting checked if they don't. Normally, But by MRI, you might be able to see it. So anything, I would say, what do we need to do? Right now, they're telling you to get into the MOVE studies. I understand there's a lot of momentum to get under 18 into the MOVE study for natural history.
Yeah.
I think, honestly, I think that everybody, even if you're an antisense, even if you're a lasmapimod, to me,
earlier is better.
Yeah. Now, a small molecule drug, you might again get concerned about development, and people do have these issues about kids are still developing, their minds are still developing. They can.
That's why the more we know about the treatments, the better mechanism of action and all that.
Right, but you might understand certain things. And again, that's why screwing with natural systems,
exactly,
such as RNAi.
If you're going to take massive amounts of melatonin, don't let your kids do that. They're still developing.
They can choose their pronouns, but don't let them choose to self-medicate on this stuff.
Because
you are still developing until you're like 25, really.
Right.
So there are some issues with development. But I do think there's a lot of reasons that pharma and biotech should include kids into trials.
Yeah, yeah.
And
good point.
As far as I'm concerned, I think saving muscle mass is one of the biggest reasons as well. Okay, so the question about financing going overseas, let me tell you, most of these trials are going to be done in the U.S. and Europe first. That's just how it's going to be.
Yeah.
I don't think you're going to be able to go to third world countries and get these things unless you're talking about like stem cell injections, exosomes. But again, those are kind of, as I've said, batshit crazy things to do. So
yes.
So that's where you're going. All right, so that's we got through 4 questions. I guess we still talk too much. I still talk too much. Sorry, I barely let you talk.
I'm good. I said plenty.
I really appreciate you taking time. I know you got to run into the lab now, and you're going to
get my last bit of data.
Last bit of data?
For the day.
No such thing as the last bit of data.
What
are you talking about? For the day, okay. All right, going to Red Lobster with your dad?
Oh, no, but he probably will want to go before he leaves. Yeah, parents in town, and trying to show him a good time. The best
right,
Reno
man.
Has to offer.
All right.
Go ahead and call me.
All right. Well, there's our podcast for the week. And thanks again to the CRISPR goddess, Carissa Maida. Don't forget, she got her book, CRISPR Evolution. Fantastic. Rave reviews, winning awards. check it out on Amazon or on her website. Kreese Jones is actually her author name. Quick shout out to my friend Scott in Shanghai. Man, I wish I knew you were out there. I didn't know you were there. I was thinking you were in Georgia still, but who knew? A couple of FSHTers getting together in Shanghai would have been pretty cool. Don't worry, I'll introduce you to the local community neurologist foundation that works there. Hey, my man Brad, the angry dad. Last week as Brad, our grieving dad, real sorry to hear about your father. Hope everything's all right, going okay now. While I read his obituary online, and you know, man, we should all strive to have such a impactful life. Great. It just seems like he was a really great dad. And I can understand why you turned out to be such a great son. Good guy. Wolf, looking forward to seeing you in a few weeks. You and the family coming through Reno. Hey, everybody, you know, summer's coming, fall's coming. Everybody's welcome to come through Reno. Check out the lab. Meet everybody. We're happy to answer all your questions in person, show you some of the research. Who knows? We might take a snip here and there and get some tools. All right. I got Man City winning the treble tomorrow. Might as well. Why not? Every team I support lost. Yeah, hell, even Frankfurt lost in the German Cup. Man, we got Benfica. Benfica won in the Portuguese League. That's Andrea's team, but that's all we got. We were like 0 for the world, man, this year. Better luck next year. Anyway. All right, we're out of here. Everybody take care. Have a good weekend. And Jagger the Kid's going to take us on home, man. Let's go.
Goodbye, soldier.
Thank you for listening to the MyFSHD podcast, where we share with you the latest news and information on FSHD as we strive for a cure. Do you have a question for Peter? He'd love to hear from you. You can reach him at peterjones@med.unr.edu. Thank you for listening, and join us again next time for more news and information.